senior biologist is here.
The third one is that right now,
in a meeting in this building,
Art is in the Royal Society in Carlton Place, which is on the Mall in London, and leads up to the back end of Buckingham Palace. So the Mall is over here, and there's this big terrace. Actually, this is the other side. It's the front. This is the terrace. Oh, here, aren't we? So it's on. This is on the Mall. The reason I mention it is the Royal Society. I'm telling you some trivia that you may not know. The Royal Society building in Carlton Place is 6-9 in London. Well, this building was built by the Third Reich as its embassy. It was actually, the architect was Albert Speer, who was Hitler's good friend, who was in charge of the German armaments program during the Third Reich. Speer also had designed a big model of the city of Berlin, where he was going to build the big Victory Arch that was like 5 times bigger than the Arc de Triomphe and so forth. Anyway, fortunately for us, they didn't build that. But that is sort of interesting that Carlton Place was taken over in 1940 after the war started by the British, and it was filled with swastika ornamentation, including furnishings and wallpaper and stuff, and the balustrades. It's kind of an interesting history. Of course, they cleaned all that stuff out and they sanitized it when they gave it to the Royal Society. When the leader of the British Fascist Party died, there was an immense funeral procession up the Mall, right next to the embassy. This is, I think, 37 or 38, if I recall. And there was a huge, and all the Nazi Party flags were out, and there was a huge, vast throng of people on the portico, on the porch, which is up here, where now there are very genteel cocktail parties, where Art will undoubtedly, as his wont, turn down a glass of wine, because he just doesn't like to drink wine. It's sort of interesting, and there is a connection to the discussion tonight, which is about the ethics of neuroscience, and I know some of you are familiar faces. I'm Jonathan Moreno, by the way.
Yeah.
You didn't know. Some of you are familiar faces. Some of you know that I'm particularly interested in the ethics of neuroscience, and I'm especially interested in the military aspects of neuroscience. So there is a little bit of a connection. I just happen to be reading, because I have really bizarre taste in leisure. Actually listening to an incredible reading of 1984. I'm a big George Orwell freak anyway. I'm in an intense Orwell phase right now. I'm reading everything that he wrote, including novels that he wrote in the 1930s and his journalism and stuff. But I'm listening because I had a couple of extra credits on audible.com. I tell you everything. I'm listening to a really brilliant, beautiful reading of 1984, which is even grimmer than I remembered it. Today, I heard this passage. There's a point in 1984. Everybody's probably has read 1984, but you probably don't remember it. You know, everybody thinks they know it, unless you've heard it again at a certain age. I don't really appreciate what a work of grim genius it is. There's a certain point at which, if you recall, the main character, Winston Smith, who's hoping that there is an underground against the party, there's a certain point at which he and his girlfriend, Julia, approach this fellow O'Brien, who is in the inner party, and they think is secretly a member of the conspiracy. They trust, they hope. Of course, he's not. And he gives them, as part of their orientation into the conspiracy against Big Brother, they give him a book. And the book is supposedly written by Emmanuel Goldstein, who is actually a.k.a. Leon Trotsky in Orwell's mind. And the book explains world history and explains the nature of the conspiracy against the party. And there's one point at which the role of science is discussed. And the point is that there is no longer any empirical science in the pre-1950 sense anywhere in the world. The only purpose of science is, empirical science, is to make continuous war. And there's this passage. The two aims of the party are to conquer the whole surface of the earth and to extinguish once and for all the possibility of independent thought. There are, therefore, two great problems which the party is concerned to solve. One is to discover how, against his will, what another human being is thinking. And the other is how to kill several hundred million people in a few seconds without giving warning beforehand. That is a light moment in the book. So, how to make sure that it is possible to discover at any moment what another human being is thinking, and how with only a few seconds, to kill hundreds of millions of people. Now, the latter, of course, Orwell knew when he wrote the book after the war, had already more or less been accomplished by the atomic bomb. The goal of the party was to do it even faster. And without the time it took for the shockwave to kill, after the initial people were incinerated, to kill tens of thousands more people, even hundreds of millions more, a hydrogen bomb that would be more instantaneous. But the former goal of the party is, of course, what really what strikes me, which is this question of how to identify what is called in Newspeak in 1984 thought crime. Thought crime is any thought that you might harbor that is in opposition to the party. And actually, there's another passage I didn't write down a little bit later in which they describe what, therefore, scientists are doing. And what they're doing is they're trying to figure out exactly how they can know what everybody's thinking through expressions on your face or through various kinds of devices that can read your brain and so forth. So, on that note, that, of course, is part of the of the focus of the ethics of neuroscience, that is, what are the limits to what can be done by learning about the brain, and how plausible is this idea of mind reading and mind control and so forth? And so it's all, it's all, see, it all ties in. Everything is relevant. Can I just do a quick show of hands? How many of you are in the dual degree program, just so I get a general idea of who's here? Medicine? How many are in med school? Med school? Law students? Nursing? Social work? Nursing? Social work? Anybody? What have I missed? Education? Anybody else? Okay. And how many of you are like just out of, green and fresh and idealistic and just out of college? Forget it. Okay, so come with me. Alright, so excuse me, I'm sorry, and I really should go around the room and have a chit chat, but maybe I get to see you under less formal circumstances some other time. Meanwhile, I am reading your minds, so I don't really ask you anything about yourselves. So the charge I have tonight is to do the history of neuroethics. And I say it's a modest history, which as some of you know me, is an uncharacteristic modifier for me. But incredibly humble. But it's got to be a modest history because nobody's written a damn history of neuroethics. So what I'm doing is just completely my view of what's happened and why neuroethics has become either a part of bioethics or, in some respects, a competitor to organized bioethics. In the specific sense that there are neuroethics journals, so there are two by my count anyway, and there is an independent neuroethics organization that doesn't meet with the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities. It meets with the Society for Neuroscience, and there are books that are published by people about neuroethics who do not consider themselves bioethicists. So there's a kind of a funny sociological, I don't know if anybody gives a damn about this, except maybe people who study bioethics. But in terms of the sort of sociology of science, there's a funny little thing going on here. And I'm sure there are multiple reasons for it, which we can speculate about. But the truth is that there is a kind of independence to neuroethics that there hasn't been about any other area of bioethics. What Art does, like organ transplant ethics, that's always been part of bioethics. Or ethics and genetics, that's always been part of bioethics, the last 40 or 50 years. Or death and dying, reproductive ethics. That's all part of the same ambit somehow of bioethics. But neuroethics has taken off a little bit on its own. And I think there are some reasons that we can identify for this that I'll try to as we go. So the first part of what we'll do tonight is just to talk about sort of the history of neuroscience and neuroethics. And then I'm going to force you to listen to me, but you can leave if you want. What I think is really where the action is in neuroethics, which is the national security counterintelligence stuff that I am very interested in. And anytime you wanted to stop me, we'll chit chat. So, how do you measure the growth of neuroscience since the 1980s? There are different ways of doing it. This is one slide pulled off the web. This is SFN, Society of Neuroscience membership. You can see what's happened. It just keeps going up. After 1998, I couldn't find a more recent chart, but how many people attended the Society of Neuroscience meetings now? Just official attendance, not even the ones who sneak in, like maybe 40,000. There are 40,000 people who go to the Society for Neuroscience. It's crazy. And it's everybody from the microscopists, to the geneticists, and everybody in between, the cognitive psychologists, so soft and hard, every dimension of study of the brain and central nervous system, the philosophers even sometimes go. Now there is it's now called the International Society for Neuroethics, because the Canadians were annoyed that it wasn't. It's called Neuroethics Society. And Canadians are very sensitive, as we know.
Yes. They are?
Oh, God. Jesus. we have a neuroscience boot camp at Penn that is terrific, that Martha Farrow runs, it's hard to get into, actually. There's a lot of applicants for it, a lot of journalists and so forth. There's a MacArthur project about neuroscience in the courtroom, the MacArthur Foundation. People at Penn are involved in that, including Steve Morris from the law school, has been very involved. How is neurotechnology going to affect gathering evidence and so forth? And this is this number of papers on fMRI. This is, pardon the pun, of course, a no-brainer. But functional MRI, it creates data, so when it became possible to combine MRI with what you were looking at or thinking about or tasting or feeling or whatever, any experience you could possibly have, functional MRI, you produce data. This is great, because funders will pay for data. They will not anymore so much pay for people to sit around at tables and talk about things the way they used to in bioethics. But they really love, if you can crank out data, that's great. So that's been a big factor in the growth of neuroscience, that you can get data. And then you can actually, this is sort of where the oxygen goes, right? Blood oxygen level. That's what they detect, for the most part, fMRI. Does that really tell you what part of the brain is doing what? I don't know. But this is what people like to think, anyway.
You can measure it.
You can measure it, exactly. You can crank out data. There are other technologies too that I'll talk about later that don't rely on what's called BOLD, but that's still a big one. I think a big moment in the history of neuroethics was clearly this meeting. Art and I were both at this meeting. There were about 100 people there, and this was sponsored, as you can see, by the Dana Foundation, by Stanford. This was at the Presidio in San Francisco. So this was 2002, May 13, 2002. There were maybe half a dozen panels. I was on a panel, Art was on a panel. I didn't know what the hell I was talking about at that point. They asked you to be a panel, the Dana Foundation, they're going to take you to San Francisco. You're going to rub elbows with a lot of scientists. How am I going to say no to that? But they did produce a book called Neuroethics Mapping the Field, which I think has been quite superseded by the stuff that's happened later. One of the stars of this meeting was Damasio, who's now at USC, who published a book about was Descartes' error, although it's never clear in the book what Descartes' error was. That's okay, it's a little bit of title. He's gotten tremendous visibility from that book. Basically, you know, I think the goal of the neuroscientists is to try to show that you can really reduce mental process to some kind of physical substrate. We'll talk more about that. So this was, I think, a really historic meeting. And I have to say that it was at this meeting that it occurred to me at the end of the meeting, because I had been interested in national security and bioethics for years before this. I published a book in the late 90s called Undue Risk about the history of human experiments and bioethics, and particularly national security-related experiments. And then a year before, around that time, I would publish a book called In the Wake of Terror about bioterrorism and bioethics. So I went to this neuroscience meeting, and I'm slow. It did not occur to me all day that there was an obvious tie-in between neuroscience and national security. I don't think any of this is recorded today. There would be, you know, video and stuff. But during the big 100-person discussion, after all the panels were finished, I said, "Is it interesting that we haven't talked at all about national security and neuroscience today?" And maybe people were tired. It was 4:30. We'd been there all day. The cocktail hour called and so forth. But I thought that my comment went over like a complete lead balloon, except for one British scientist, older guy, who looked at me and smiled. So I don't know who he was anymore. I don't remember who he was. But I did come away from that meeting thinking that there was something here, sort of following on history of human experiments, following on bioterrorism. There's something about neuroscience and national security as well. So I started, I knew a little bit about what the Defense Department was doing with neuroscience, not much. I knew that there was a cutting-edge science agency called DARPA, which you probably know about, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. DARPA is more famous now than it was by far 10 years ago. But they create, you know, they developed the internet was their product in the late 60s. Also, this, you know, the stealth bomber and the computer mouse, and they do lots of very interesting stuff. We'll talk about that a little more later. But because I had published this book about national security human experiments, I would frequently, and I still do, get calls from people or emails from people, or they show up at my office unexpectedly, who are sure that their brains are being controlled by the CIA. That's not a joke. I can tell you that is true. It's a big issue, a big problem for the President's Commission. Problem of they're called in the trade the TIs, targeted individuals. There are thousands and thousands of these folks. Some of them are extremely functional, some of them are not. But because of that, I've been in contact with these people for years. My father was a psychiatrist who treated their forebears. So I sort of interested in this. And I heard a lot about DARPA from them. So I thought, well, you know, what is DARPA really doing with the brain? At that point, after my talk to Dana at this event, I was asked at some point, maybe a year later, to write a piece for Cerebrum, which is Dana's magazine. It's no longer in print, of course, like everything else. It's only on the web. The Dana Foundation, and this is sort of funny thing with the Dana Foundation, the Dana Foundation spends hundreds of millions of dollars on neuroscience research, but this is the only neuroethics thing they basically have ever done. A few other things, but not much. So the president of the Dana Foundation at that time was a man who had been Richard Nixon's speechwriter, and whose name I'm now, William Sapphire. William Sapphire was one of President Nixon's speechwriters. He's given credit for writing a lot of Vice President Agnew's speeches, the nattering nabobs of negativism, for example. This came from Sapphire's pen, and he, you may remember, he died a couple years ago, you may remember that he wrote a column for the New York Times Magazine every Sunday called On Language, which is wonderful. A great wordsmith, Sapphire. And very funny, very witty. But Sapphire was also president of the Dana Foundation. Why was Sapphire interested in the Dana Foundation? Why was he interested in neuroscience? Well, I'm deeply interested. And it was only kind of after I met him that I realized that he was interested because he's a libertarian. And as a libertarian, he was concerned about the implications of brain research for privacy. So, making a long story way too long, I was asked if I wanted to write something from Cerebrum. I had been thinking for a while after this meeting about a piece. I only had a title in mind, but very often a title is all you need, because then you know what goes behind the title. Right? And so the title that I had in mind was DARPA on Your Mind. That is the most downloaded piece I've ever written. It's been downloaded, I don't know, thousands of times. And it was published in Cerebrum, and then Sapphire wrote it, and then they asked me if I wanted to write a book, so I did. It took a couple of years. That's another story. I'll tell you a little bit of my mind wars in a few minutes. But for me, and I think for a lot of people, this was kind of a turning point in an interest in bioethics and the brain. This view. Now, I should say that about 20 years before this, a philosopher named Patricia Churchland had, at UC San Diego, published a book called Neurophilosophy. And if you want to dig deeper into the more philosophical rather than strictly bioethical aspects of neuroscience, you should really look at Pat's book. She was subsequently given one of the MacArthur Genius Awards and sort of drummed out of academic philosophy, even though she's still in the department. Because she was really much more interested in the brain than she was in the mind, which is like a big crime in academic philosophy. So people had been thinking about how the new brain science might inform philosophy for decades. In fact, I'm going to actually say for longer than that. And Pat was at one of the people at this on one of the panels at this meeting. So this was a very historic meeting, I think. And again, it comes up at a time when the study of neuroscience is growing like crazy. There's a lot of money for neuroscience, so Dana decided to do this meeting. So neuroethics has become a thing. Here's a textbook by Neil Levy, who's Australian. Jim Giordano has just brought out this anthology. Giordano is a fellow at the Potomac Institute in Arlington, which is a Beltway bandit. That writes white papers for the Defense Department. They have a number of DARPA alumni on their board and among their fellows. This is a new one. Right now, Martha's book on neuroethics, a really terrific anthology. Martha Ferrer is a cognitive psychologist here. She runs a center for neuroscience and society here at Penn. And they've done very well. In fact, in the fall, a little advertisement, those of you still in the program, I'll be teaching a course called Neuroethics with Martha. She's going to be a co-teacher. She's actually going to come in and talk about the science, which takes all the pressure off me, because I can only fake it. So, with Martha's book, there was this conference about a month ago at Tufts on Neuroethics and Homeland Security, which is quite interesting. There's government-level interest now in a big way, in neuroethics and ethics and neuroscience. So right now, I'm writing what's called a staff report for the President's Commission on Bioethics that's, as you know, chaired by Amy Guttman. So I'm supposed to deliver it in the fall, and basically what I'm going to do is just lay out what's going on in neuroscience and the ethical issues. Very broad staff report for them. And if the President wins and if the Commission continues, that staff report may be the basis of a full-scale report by the Commission with recommendations and findings and so forth. Meanwhile, though, the British quasi-formal government bioethics commission, the Nuffield Council, is doing its own report on neuroethics. And that will probably be finished sometime next year. Getting into the national security area again, the Royal Society, where art is today, had a workshop in about 11 months ago on neuroscience and national security. I actually took the wrong cover on here. I'm sorry. Module 3 is on neuroethics and national security. So I was at a workshop there where I met a whole bunch of people from among Brits and others who are interested in neuroscience and the military. So there's a lot going on in neuroethics, and there's this overlap with national security issues. And this is the cover of the book that I published in 2006. And this is the table of contents. Some of you might have read some of my works, I can't remember, in other contexts. Since 2006, a lot has happened on the neurotechnology side, and this is just one example of what's going on here. Real money is being spent. Since in fiscal year 2011, these are the numbers based on some data that Margaret Kosel of Georgia Tech has put together. So this is just published numbers. We don't know what else is going on, who else is doing what. There are what are called informally black budgets of research and development in the national security world, the counterintelligence world. We don't know exactly everything that's going on. It's also possible to show, that there has been a kind of 9/11 effect. I published this a little while ago. If you look at this axis is the number of articles that have been published, and this is a year, and this is based on keywords like mind reading, fMRI, national security, terrorism, a bunch of keywords that I use, and this is the way it looks. So, in other words, from around 2001 to around 2010, you see this big spike of papers that are published that have to do with neuroscience, counterintelligence, terrorism. Deception was a big literature on functional MRI and detecting deception, right? Interrogation-related issues. So, actually, it turns out, if you look at what other people have done along these lines, that there's a 9/11 effect all over science. Because what happens, as some of you who have had to get grants will have to get grants to support yourselves know, you've got an idea for a project. There's an RFA that comes out. You say, okay, that's easy. I can tweak it. I can ask an extra question or two that will make it work under this funding program. And that's what people have obviously been doing. And then there's this completely predictable natural drop, because what happens is that this data, there are new RFAs, the funders lose interest in this question, and then the data gets integrated into the science more generally. And so this is what the new book is going to look like, the revised, expanded, and updated, which is going to be out in a few weeks. Can you see what that image is? I hope that image makes sense to you.
Like it? It's better than the first cover.
It's better than the first cover, yeah. Well, simplicity is the thing now. So that's the way the cover looks now. What I'm going to do now, though, is I'm going to come back to some of the national security stuff later on. And again, stop me whenever you want to. These are sort of going to be the topics. And I'm going to spend quite a bit of time now on what I think of as the era before neuroscience. And I'm being somewhat selective here. I'm going to start with Ferrier, just because you've got to start somewhere. And again, this is sort of pre-neuroscience, the use of electricity in surgery to get brain localization. Ferrier was a Scot who developed during open skull surgery. He developed this map of the brain of a dog. You'll be happy to know that's a dog's brain. He identified different areas where if you stimulated it, you'd get a reaction. Some of you might have done this with a frog in high school biology or something. I don't know. A lot of people were doing this kind of work, but he was the first one, as far as I know, who actually mapped a mammal's brain with respect to localization. And then, as you know, there are a lot of surgeons who, while they were doing they were doing some neurosurgery. They put little electrodes in, and you know, they had fun seeing which parts of the body danced and so forth. So this isn't phrenology, right? Phrenology was this notion that you could tell by the shape of somebody's head, bumps on the skull, and so forth, what was going on in their brains. But there's a kind of an odd sort of justification for phrenology, except it turns out that it's further in. An interest in the brain as the, you know, Aristotle thought that the brain was just a cooling mechanism for the blood. So interest in the brain has picked up a lot in the last few hundred years, and people started identifying it because they observed injuries to the brain, and they saw that people really changed. The most famous case is somebody named Phineas Gage, who was working was a railroad worker in the 19th century, and through an obvious accident, a spike went through his skull, and his personality completely changed. And that was one of the cases that gave people really a terrific interest in trying to understand brain localization. Efforts to map the brain by the neurosurgeons in the late 19th century, this was part of what was going on. There was another kind of movement by my favorite philosopher, psychologist William James, who created the framework for modern psychology in a textbook called The Principles of Psychology. There's a great story about William James when he was at Harvard. Henry Holt asked him if he'd be interested in writing a textbook on psychology, because the psychology books at that time were sort of Hegelian. They were really crap, it was sort of philosophy of mind, very speculative stuff. It was not integrating the new things that were going on in laboratories in places like Berlin and Vienna. And so James said, "Well, that's easy. I can do that." For a year, that was 1878. He delivered it in 1890. It took him 12 years to write the 2-volume Principles of Psychology, which is an incredible, incredible book. I highly recommend to you. But James was the first, for example, to really articulate the idea of the engram, neural engraining, the idea of neuroplasticity. He figured out that habits are really registered in gray matter, as it were, in neurons and glial cells. He didn't have the cellular stuff, but he understood the basic framework of the way that the brain works as mind. He gave us the idea of the stream of consciousness. Right? It's all in James. He also had an idea of the unconscious. There's a famous story, William James, this is 1900, he died in 1910, I think it was 1906, 1907. For the first time, Sigmund Freud is invited to the U.S. to give a series of lectures. His first lecture is at Clark University. And there's a wonderful story about how old Professor James, old Dr. James, is being taken by the arm to walk in the garden before Freud's lecture. And James, at one point, gets down on the ground and holds his chest. He's having an attack. Freud's in shock. And Freud looks at him. He recovers after a few minutes and gets up. James, unlike Freud, did not believe in libidinal energy and so forth. James was a Victorian who thought that you shouldn't talk about those things. Freud was a Victorian who enjoyed talking about those things. James did create an atmosphere in which it was more possible to talk about the unconscious. But the point that that James makes in the Principles of Psychology is that ultimately there is a physical substratum that's going on that you have to understand if you understand psychology. You need to experiment. And this was a great contribution that James made to psychology. You need to be in the laboratory. He also believed that in order to be a good person, essentially, in a kind of Victorian sense, have good habits, you had to strike out hard on the habit every time you had the chance to act on it. He gave lectures to teachers. He was a very popular lecturer to civic organizations, because the point of understanding psychology for citizens is partly understanding how to make your mind work for you as he put it, how to make your nervous system your ally instead of your enemy. So striking out on good habits, digging those neural ingrains really deep. He understood them as electrical charges. Right? That your brain is changed with every experience you have. Rick Santorum said that there's evidence that pornography changes your brain. And that happens to be true. Maybe he's reading his William James, I don't know. But the fact is that everything changes your brain. Every experience does. Every new experience you have changes your brain, and every new experience you have is approached, according to James, with a completely different brain than the one you had a flash of a second ago. Your brain is in constant change, therefore you're experiencing constant change. This is the stream of consciousness. And you're not aware of most of it, because we only attend to certain things at a certain time. Again, that's the unconscious. But he wasn't going for that sex thing in the way Freud did. Freud really moved more in that direction, I think it's fair to say. But Freud also, and this is the important thing about Freud, Freud also believed, like James, that ultimately psychotherapy was going to be physical. That it was going to actually get to the physical basis of the conscious and the unconscious mind. You know, what he was doing, Freud believed that what he did in psychoanalysis was interesting, but he never thought he was going to cure anybody. And in fact, he really didn't. It was intellectually interesting. It certainly had interesting implications for thinking about, you know, dreams and for taboo and so forth. It had interesting anthropological implications. But ultimately, psychology, in Freud's view, was going to have to be reduced to physiology, to psychophysiology. This is what he shared with James. I put that up there just because I like the cover. It's pretty cool. But there's more to the story, because even while Freud was doing psychoanalysis, there were other people around who were really trying to do neurophysiology and really didn't like what Freud was up to at all. Now, of course, Freud was at the peak of his career in the 19-teens at the University of Vienna Medical School. Happens to be where my father went to medical school. In fact, my father had Freud as a lecturer. So this is Dad, which you can't really see. This is a sketch of Dad when he was a medical student. This is a rather hairy young man. And this was my father's professor, who was Wagner von Jarosz. I'd like to have that guy come to your bedside. von Jarosz won the Nobel Prize for malaria therapy in 1928. And the idea was that he would take people like this gentleman, who had tertiary syphilis, and he would raise the body temperature. He tried different ways of doing this. He would raise the body temperature to kind of kill off the spirochete for a while. And he tried different ways of doing this, and finally he hit on malaria, gave them malaria. So this is a guy who is actually having blood from a patient with malaria injected into him. And for that, because he did in fact get some remission from the symptoms of tertiary syphilis, for that he was given the Nobel Prize. See, it's not that hard to get a Nobel Prize. just have to kind of hit it right. There is a connection between my father, who, as I said, had Freud as a lecturer, but he was in the von Jarosz clinic. That's where he was a medical student resident in their system, in the von Jarosz clinic. This would have been around 1915, 1916, 1917. And the story that my father told me about von Jarosz and Freud was this. Von Jarosz gave an order to Moreno and all of the other medical students in his clinic not to allow Freud or any of his students into the building. That has really not changed that much in the history of medicine. People were still pissed off at each other for various things. But he saw Freud as a quack, essentially. Meanwhile, people with malaria cured them with their syphilis, so who's to say? I talked a little bit about Orwell at the beginning, and now I want to just tell you something about Brave New World, because there's a whole bunch of neuroscience in Brave New World, which I also reread recently. There's also, by the way, a whole lot more sex in Brave New World than I remembered when I read it when I was 14. I probably didn't quite get it, as it were. But in Brave New World, neuroscience is actually very important. Because if you remember, the key to keeping people happy in Brave New World, and this is to remind you, these are the principal characters of Huxley's Brave New World. The key to keeping people happy in Brave New World there were two, right? What was one?
Soma,
right? Which was a drug that was supposed to have no bad side effects whatsoever, but it just put you in a lovely dreamlike state. If you were neurotic, it would calm you down. It was sort of like, I don't know, Prozac and Klonopin and acid and mescaline and everything, all rolled into one. Opium, morphine, it was the perfect drug. And these are the people who were the sort of dramatis personae. But there are a number of bioethics themes in Brave New World that just point them out to you. There's Soma, which is the neuroethics, which kept everybody sweet and kind and lovely to each other. There's also cloning going on. I just point this out in passing. There's a whole issue about human dignity, which is why John the Savage, spoiler alert, finally kills himself. Obviously, there's a lot of eugenics going on. Eugenics is going on, though, in the hatchery. Do you remember the hatchery? The eugenics that's going on in the hatchery is extremely primitive, because this is 1952. So they haven't solved the genome yet. So what are they using in the hatchery? You remember this? The principal, the only chemical they mentioned to modify the embryos? It's funny, it's alcohol. You expose them to alcohol at the right time, and you keep them nice and sweet. Here's the, so this is the central London hatchery and conditioning center. They knew about fetal alcohol syndrome, but they knew that would really screw up an embryo. But they really didn't know much about other chemicals might work in vitro. So they were pretty limited. They also, of course, as I point out to my students, when I talk about Brave New World, had no artificial placenta, right? They had IVF, but no artificial placenta. They had an artificial placenta. We don't. So they were manufacturing them, and that, of course, is one of the reasons that Roe v. Wade actually has only gone so far, right? Because if we had an artificial placenta, then we could carry a baby to term without a woman's body. That would be no problem. But we don't have that. They did in Brave New World, and that's the big difference. So it turns out to be harder to do that than we originally thought. And it really is interesting that when I started in bioethics in the early 80s, and we talked about Roe v. Wade, which was the 1973 decision that everybody thinks about all the time these days, and then years later, Sandra O'Connor said that the trimester system in the Roe v. Wade decision is at war with itself, because ultimately the technology is going to take us, earlier than 22 weeks, you're going to get babies gone. But it really hasn't so far. It turned out to be a lot harder to make that artificial placenta than people thought. So there's Brave New World, and of course there's eugenics in it. These are the kind of people you have. Standard gammas, deltas, epsilons, the alpha plus intellectuals, that's everybody here, of course. But it seems to be through chemicals in a very primitive way that they kept people, some people stupid, they kept people uniform through cloning. That's all, it's pretty vague. But as I said to you, the real secret of Brave New World, you really need, don't take it from me, read it again, is sex. People are having sex like bonobos in Brave New World. Whereas in 1984, by contrast, sex is an act of rebellion, which I think is really interesting, right? You have two dystopias, and sex plays exactly the opposite role in one and the other. And there, of course, is Soma. The interesting thing about Huxley, all pre-neuroscience, right? This is 1932. Interesting about Huxley is that he really wanted to find Soma in his own life. If you read Huxley's the biographies of Huxley, he was very interested in mescaline. He was excited about LSD. There is a story that as he was dying, he took LSD. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems very clear that he did use LSD. Timothy Leary, who met Huxley and admired him greatly, of course, did trip as he was dying. don't know if you can do it. In Oregon, can you get LSD and die?
Is it suicide? I don't know if that's possible.
I know, of course, what that has led to is what we today call cosmetic, you know, psychopharmacology or cosmetic pharmacology. You know, Prozac is a favorite of this. Just bringing this to the way I love this. This is a series of great writers on Prozac. So this is Poe on Prozac. Quote the Raven, hey, things could be a lot worse. This is I think it was in the New Yorker, this series. There was one, Marx on Prozac. He's saying to Engels, you know, those capitalists, they're not so bad.
Yeah, great idea.
So, and I put the Hastings Center, Lily, the thing. Do you know the story about Lily and the Hastings Center? So, the Hastings Center published a piece in which some of the data about Prozac and suicide risk came up. Now, Lilly had given the Hastings Center, this is like 10 years ago, a grant, a sort of unrestricted grant. And that money somehow disappeared after Hastings Center published that piece. It never fully materialized. Now, was it so? Of course, Lilly said, no, I didn't do it that. It's just that the Lilly Foundation's orientation changed and they weren't doing that anymore, weren't supporting ethics that way anymore. I think people at Hastings Center are always suspicious about what really happened with that. But it's sort of interesting. Little story of Lilly and the Hastings Center. Coming up closer to the 50s, of course, we have the role of LSD in the culture, I'm going to come to that. But so this is the Manchurian Candidate. You have to know a lot about movies to be in my lecture. So this is the original Manchurian Candidate, not the remake, which was terrible, but the new one was pretty interesting. But the old one was pretty interesting. And you know who this is? Frank Sinatra being brainwashed. So the Manchurian Candidate is taking off on the anxieties that people had in the 50s about what was going on with our prisoners of war in North Korea and China. There were lots of treasonous statements being made, false confessions being made. And one of the concerns was that the culprit here was some kind of drug that we really didn't fully understand, that the Koreans, the North Koreans and the Chinese were using with our people. And you may remember that LSD was only really accidentally discovered in 1939 by a Swiss-German chemist when he was doing some experiments with ergot one afternoon. And he kind of put it on the shelf. He didn't know what its properties were. And then a couple of years later, I think it was 1942, he actually decided to test it out. And the guy, and, you know, some reagents or something. And this fellow was also, it seems, a bit of a nail biter. He got some of the LSD on his fingers that day in 1942. And apparently he had a really, really interesting bike ride home. So that was the beginning. He died, by the way, at the age of 101. So maybe we should all be on acid. It seemed to work. But acid was new. It was a funny thing with chemicals. In the 1940s, there was LSD and hallucinogens that were being kind of synthetic hallucinogens. But then there were also these horrible, sarin and teva, somen. This category of drugs that are so lethal that a single drop can kill dozens of people. So funny things were going on with chemicals in the 40s because there was a huge chemical industry. They were the leading chemical producer, chemical research in the world. So, coming out of the dyestuffs industry in the late 19th century. So, this whole business of, could they brainwash our people with something like LSD became a big concern here at home. This is Alan Dulles, who is the brother of John Foster Dulles, after whom Dulles Airport is named, if you ever wondered. Who that Dulles is. It was John Foster, the Secretary of State, his brother. I guess they were sort of the Emanuel brothers of the 50s. I don't know, the Dulleses. Anyway, that was coming. So, he was the director of the CIA. He commissioned a report on what was going on with our prisoners of war. And they were debriefed by two neurologists from Cornell Medical Center, New York Hospital, named Wolf and Hinkle.
And actually, you can read the Wolf-Nickel report. It's online. It's heavily redacted, but you can read it, what's left of it. And so they looked at this whole thing. Was this brainwashing? They conclude that it was not brainwashing. That it was not LSD. That they were, that whatever you call it, brainwashing or mind control, whatever was done to our people to make them sign these false confessions, was done through some techniques that we don't really understand, the psychological thing, peer pressure, you know, group stuff that they were really good at. So, but it wasn't LSD. However, they were very concerned in the CIA about what LSD could do. If, let's imagine that you're a physicist with a high level clearance and you're at an international meeting, you know something about atomic secrets. And you know, at the end of the day, you go out to dinner with some colleagues and somebody doses you with some LSD. Could it make, and in the language of the 1950s, could it make a discreet man indiscreet? So they were worried, so they sponsored a bunch of experiments. I won't go into too many of the details of the LSD experiments. It's a fascinating story. It takes place in the 1950s. This is Sidney Gottlieb, who was the fellow who was in charge of the experiments in the CIA. He was also the fellow who tried to get a poison cigar to Fidel Castro. Also tried to poison Patrice Lumumba, a Congolese freedom fighter. In the end, Patrice Lumumba was killed by some rivals the old-fashioned way, rifles. Everybody who's tried to kill Fidel Castro is already dead. But I don't know. I'm just going to go on and on and on. It's sort of amazing. He also funded the hallucinogen experiments, which took place all over the country. This only came out in the mid-1970s. And one of the programs that involved LSD was called MKUltra. It has no significance whatsoever. MKUltra, they just put out of the air, and that's what they called it. It was a code name. And so you know some of the things that they did under MKUltra? Anybody who...
It was drug people very public.
Yeah, basically, you know, for example, there's a story, a guy gave LSD to a singer in a San Francisco bar.
Yeah.
Just put it in her drink. You know, didn't see her for a week, and after he saw her again, he sidled up to her and said, gee, I haven't seen you, but it's been okay. She said, yeah, but geez, I've given up drinking. I had a hell of a bender last week. So they would just go around. Now, you couldn't even dignify it by calling them experiments. They were just going around giving, putting in people's drinks and seeing what happened. So this is a... virtually all of the literature, all of the records on MK Ultra and related experiments is gone. This is one of the few documents that's left. You can see heavily redacted. It was formally classified top secret. Signed by Sidney Gottlieb in June 1953. And I just want to... This is subproject 8. I have to say, reading this stuff at the moment, since I'm listening to 1984 on audible.com, it really works. So this is a study of LSD, LSD antagonists, and so on and so forth. So this is the kind of thing they were looking at. $38,500 of taxpayer money being spent on this particular project. Now, the interesting thing is that this is an accounting document. So what seems to have happened is that the only documents that were left after the records were sanitized by the CIA directors in the early 70s, before they could be discovered and exposed, the only records that were left were accounting documents. They forgot that. Every bureaucracy, have you ever been in charge of an office? You always have to have a paper trail. So where is the money spent? And they forgot about these. So this is one of the accounting documents that actually help people understand the nature and extent of the experiments. So you've taken bioethics, research ethics, know about Henry Beecher? Mm-hmm. So did you know that he was a CIA informant? This is not well known. It's really interesting. Even now in bioethics, I've given some talks about it. But we're very well established that Beecher, who was, of course, a professor at Penn for a while, and then went to be the first chair professor of anesthesiology in the country, produced dozens of professors of anesthesiology in his career, did very important work during the Second World War on anesthesiology for wounded soldiers. He started to report first to the OSS, Office for Strategic Services, and then the CIA after the war on LSD. He would go to meetings, and then he would write to people back at CIA headquarters about interesting scientists he had met who knew something about hallucinogens, people in Britain, people in the continent, who we should know about. And this went on through the late 1950s. Of course, the interesting thing about Beecher is he also became the great hero of research ethics, who wrote papers about unethical human experiments. And it would be really interesting to know what his thinking was. He also used LSD, apparently, as a control drug in his anesthesiology experiments at Mass General. So, you know, he was. It is also known that he was a devout Christian. He read the Bible every day. He was a very interesting man. He was not born Henry Beecher. He was born Henry Unangst in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. That's where Rush Limbaugh is from, too, by the way. But on his mother's side, they were distantly related to the Beechers, of Harry Beecher Stowe, Henry Ward Beecher. And so when he got to Boston, he changed his name to Beecher. It was hipper to be a Beecher at Harvard than it was to be who next, by far. Bob Levine, the research ethicist at Yale, who published the original book on research ethics, you should read that book if you haven't. Bob Levine also told me that he was bisexual, Beecher. He knew him pretty well. In many ways, Beecher lived a double life, right? Unangst, Beecher, ethicist, CIA informant, straight, gay, right? A very complicated person. And unfortunately, he died in 1975, just as the Church Commission and the Rockefeller Commission were looking back at the old CIA activities in the 50s and 60s, just as the scandal was coming out. So we never really had an opportunity to learn what his thinking was. He never had an opportunity to talk about his experience in that era, which is really a shame. And there does not seem to be much of a set of Beecher papers that would help us to write a biography. There really should be a biography of Henry Beecher. It's terrifically important. As you probably know, he wrote the most important paper in the history of research ethics in 66, which he published in the Journal of Medicine, including talking about the Willowbrook hepatitis studies, the Berkeley Jewish chronic disease case, live cancer cells and debilitated elderly patients. He was a hero, a very complicated guy. He also, I think, I'm theorizing here, but I also think that the Beecher connection for him was also that he was the kind of an abolitionist himself. He wanted to abolish the subjugation of human subjects in research studies. He was kind of this was a civil rights activity for him, as a Christian, as a Beecher. And quite apart from the LSD stuff, Lou Lasagna, who was his most famous student, died a couple of years ago, a great Tufts University Medical School professor. Lasagna, when the Radiation Exposure Advisory Committee interviewed Lasagna in the mid-90s, and said, you knew Beecher very well. You were his lab assistant. You were his protege. Did you ever talk to him about, the fact that he was doing LSD experiments, but he was also writing these articles about research ethics? And well, he said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I did." I said, "Henry, what? You're writing these articles on research ethics. What about what we were doing?" And he said, "I know, Louis, but I'm trying to make a point here." So people are complicated. This is all pre-neuroscience stuff. And of course, this is what's really important. There's a little book called The Harvard Psychedelic Club that came out 2 years ago. Have you seen this book? Pre-neuroscience, but very much part of the culture, and very bizarre. The long and the short of it is that we have Henry Beecher and other Harvard professors doing research on psychedelics in the 50s, quietly. Then a couple of young psychologists come, Tim Leary and Richard Alpert, come to Harvard as research psychologists, and they show up in 58-59. In 1960, Timothy Leary takes a vacation in Mexico, and he comes back with a suitcase full of mushrooms. It's true. He and Richard Alpert, who is now known as Baba Ramdas, if you don't know who Baba Ramdas is, I'm sorry, you have to Google it. He and Alpert decide that they should actually try some experiments with some of their graduate students, which they do. This is called the Harvard Psychedelic Club. And they get a pass on this from the psychology department on the understanding that they will not give any to the undergraduates. They also start a project at the Concord Prison. It's called the Concord Prison Experiment, where they give psychedelics to prisoners. And they claim that they do very well, that when they're released, you know, they're fine. They've abandoned their life of crime. Now, you know, I'm not sure if they really kept good records on the recidivism rate from these prisoners who were tripping out in the Concord prison, but it was sort of famous. Finally, this guy, Andrew Weil. This is Andrew Weil then. This is Andrew Weil with the beard. You know who Andrew Weil is, right? The big, what, I don't know, macrobiotic, whatever his thing is. He's on the PBS all the time telling you what you should eat. He's an undergraduate who's writing for the Harvard Crimson. He feels a little excluded, according to the book, by what's going on, because there's a certain number of undergraduates who are kind of in the club, you know, favorites of Leary and Alpert. He blows the whistle. He writes an article on the Harvard Crimson. Alpert is then told he needs to leave town, leave Harvard, and Leary follows him. And the rest, as they say, is history. Leary pitches his tent in Millbrook, New York, where he starts an LSD commune, being supported by a very wealthy woman. G. Gordon Liddy, who is one of the Watergate burglars, is a cop in Dutchess County. This is right near where I grew up. Liddy gets the county helicopter, state trooper helicopter, and buzzes the estate in Millbrook whenever he can to harass Leary et al. You may know that Leary and Liddy then went on a big lecture tour 10 years later, in the 1970s. These guys deserve each other. Leary also escaped from prison with the help of the Black Panthers. He got to Africa. I mean, what a life. Crazy stuff. But you know, this was happening. All kinds of things were going on here. How many people here believe in ESP, for example? Don't be shy. That special someone, you know, that you have a connection with. This is J.B. Ryan, the great Duke professor of psychology, who was trying to apply rigorous scientific method to try to figure out whether there is ESP. Some people have it, some people don't. He, too, was supported by the CIA and was an informant by the CIA. He coined the term PSYOPs, or psychological operations. This is serious business. I want to read this passage to you from a 1988 National Academy of Sciences report called Enhancing Human Performance. I'm not making this up. Because ESP, psychokinesis, telekinesis, you know what remote viewing is? Remote viewing is the alleged ability that some people have to see a place that they've never been. And you put your finger on someplace on the map and something concentrates and they can, oh yes, they can see it. All kinds of stuff was going on that the Defense Department and the counterintelligence community were investigating along these lines. So this is from 1988. The concern in 88 was that among some of the neuroscientists and people in the uniform military was that there was a mind race. That the Soviets were investing a lot more money in ESP, psychokinesis. Remember Uri Geller, the Israeli who could bend a spoon, telekinesis, who could bend a spoon just with his brain power? Remember that stuff? Well, somebody, I'm looking at you like, remember. But he's still around. He's still around, Uri Geller. So the worry was that the Soviets, you know, we beat them in the space race. But this is now the 1980s. Were they getting ahead of us in the mind race? So this was the concern of this report by the National Academy of Sciences. I'm going to read this to you. I know you can read, but I just love reading this. So the claimed phenomena and applications presented by several military officers to the National Academy's committee range from the incredible to the outrageously incredible. The anti-missile time warp, for example, is somehow supposed to deflect attack from nuclear warheads so that they will transcend time and explode among the ancient dinosaurs. Now, wait. I read that, was it Philip K. Dick? Was that that's? I read that story. You know, they go back in time, and they go, and then somebody, when they come back, and then everything's a little different. You know, it's a little different. And somebody lifts up his boot, and they realize he's stepping on a butterfly. Okay, back in like millions of years ago, and that's enough to change their biological history. Okay, so I guess they didn't read that story because I don't know. They destroyed the dinosaurs when they did, would we have shown up? I'm not sure. Anyway, one suggested application is the conception of the first Earth Battalion made up of warrior monks, including the use of ESP, leaving their bodies at will, levitating, psychic healing, and walking through walls. Okay, I'm not making this up. You can go online, National Academies Press, Enhancing Human Performance. The whole chapter is just incredible. And of course, it did turn into a movie, which some of you might have seen. Called The Men Who Stare at Goats. Anybody see the movie? Yeah, disappointing. The trailer was much funnier. This is George Clooney playing one of the First Earth Battalion warrior monks. And the idea here is he's staring at a goat, and the idea is that you stare at a goat until it has a heart attack and dies. There are actually people being trained to do this. Your tax dollars, or perhaps your parents' tax dollars, at work. So, not making this up.
So what paranoia drove this time?
It's a very good question. Yeah. One of my former neighbors in Washington was a guy, John Wilhelm, who wrote a book, in 1970. Wilhelm was trained as an undergrad as a physicist at Princeton, and then he went off to be a reporter for Time magazine. He reported on the Vietnam War. He reported on the Tet Offensive. And he came back after a couple of years to find that America from 1968 to 1970 was a really different place. So he decided to write a book about the weird shit that was going on with the CIA, including remote viewing and so on and so forth. I can't remember the name of the book now, but I write about it in Mind Wars because I interviewed him. And I said, John, what the hell is going on? You know, did they really believe they could do this? He said, you know, I don't know. And he said, actually, the further away I get from that period, the less I understand it. It's possible that it was disinformation. That they were trying to get the Soviets to spend money on this psychic stuff. And in fact, if you go online, you will find all kinds of articles about psychotronics, which is one of the terms that was used for the Soviet mind control program. Who knows? You know. Now, of course, anybody who has worked with people in the security world knows that a major concern that they have is staying ahead of the other guy. So, you know, if there's any possibility at all that something could be useful, we're going to try to find out about it. Unless Congress tells us we can't. Right? We're going to try to find out. So there are probably some people who really believed that there was something going on here. And, you know, you didn't want to be the person who said, eh, it's bullshit, and then, you know, the Soviets figure out how to control our brains, right? So, and you know, it's amazing how this never goes away. Remember this story? This was a story that Rolling Stone published, that when John McCain went to, with a number of other senators, went to Kabul a couple of years ago, it's 2009, that there were psychological operations planned and executed on the senators to make them sympathetic to the war in Afghanistan. Okay, did you read this? This is right. It was a Rolling Stone. And of course, the bizarreness of it is that, you know, this is John McCain, right? He was a prisoner of war. I mean, anybody who knows about mind control and brainwashing and torture, it's him. Okay, so it's really weird. Rolling Stone ultimately had to withdraw the story because they were relying on one informant who turned out to be unreliable. So, but just as an illustration of how this stuff never completely goes away. This is all you know, the ethics of neuroscience. So this is actually, I mentioned my father before, who was a psychiatrist. Henry Murray was one of his closest friends.
I don't think people ever even know who Henry Murray is anymore, but he was one of the most important psychologists of the 20th century. He was, if you read any personality theory, if you read a book called Assessment of Men, he developed the TAT, the Manahan Perception Test, at Harvard in the 40s, for the Army during World War II. One of the first, you know, pretty reliable psychometric tests. He was a great psychologist, and he was director of the Harvard Psychological Clinic. One of the experiments that Murray did involved 23 Harvard undergraduates in the late 50s, all men, of course, it was Harvard, and Radcliffe and women were Harvard. Women were Radcliffe, men were Harvard. And they were humiliation. Anybody know about this? These were humiliation experiments. Yeah, basically, they tried to take these young men and write. They wrote about their sort of, you know, your life's ideals. This is the 50s, right? So, you know, very people are very idealistic, not as cynical as we are. And then they were basically cross-examined about this paper until some of them were reduced to tears. And this was not just one session; there were several sessions. Who was doing the experiments and who was one of the Harvard undergraduates who was in those experiments? Well, Henry Murray with a young man named Ted Kaczynski, otherwise known as the Unabomber. So I'm not saying that Harvard turned Ted Kaczynski psychotic, but it's been known to happen. So Kaczynski actually has written about these experiments, these humiliation experiments. This was not DOD funded or anything. This was just something that Murray was interested in. As an exercise in deconstructing personality. So, yeah.
This is pre-new research ethics for pre-IRBs at these various institutions.
Yeah, there were no IRBs there. There were IRBs, but not so much for social behavioral. You had to get, there were places, the City of Hope, apparently, in California, Duarte, California, had an IRB in the late 30s. The BI in Boston had an IRB. There were IRB-like processes at the NIH Clinical Center, but they were biomedical. Right? There were no behavioral IRBs. Interestingly, Henry only published one paper about this in 61, and he didn't identify the subjects of the experiment. Just to give you an idea, again, how involved people were in those days, at the highest levels of academia, in the national security environment, neuroscience and national security going hand in hand. Kurt Lewin, some of you know who Kurt Lewin is, father of modern social psychology, also an OSS advisor on psychological warfare. This has gone on in all the major places in the 40s and 50s. Close relationship between what I call the pre-neuroscience world and academia and national security. Okay. Before I leave this topic, any questions so far? This is all. They haven't even gotten to the juicy stuff yet on national security, the more recent stuff. But I do want to show you this. Some of you have seen this, I know. Some of you haven't.
Field conditions, a simple exercise was devised. The troops were given the same quantity of water to drink before each day's exercise. Unknown to the troops, the drug was added to the water on the second day. The drug was given orally to the men in the hospital ward at 11:15.
It's LSD.
And they immediately imbibed, arriving at the exercise area 10 minutes later. At 11:40, the first effects of the drug make their appearance. The men no longer take cover, they relax and begin to giggle. At this time, one man is more severely affected than the others, losing all contact with reality, dropping his rifle, and becoming unable to take any part in the operation. In fact, he has to be withdrawn from the exercise a few minutes later. Section 2 starts to advance to Redwood. The troops have lost their air of urgency, and many men are laughing. Meanwhile, radio communication at the beaches has become difficult, if not impossible. Men with no specific task to perform have relapsed into laughter and inconsequential behavior, though they are still capable of sustained physical effort. This man nearly succeeded in felling this tree using only a spade. 70 minutes after the administration of the drug, with one man climbing a tree, the troop commander gives up, saying, "I cannot do anything about this. I cannot control the man, and I can take no action myself. I am wiped out as an attacking force."
So, I've seen actually some more footage. I saw it last May when I was in London. And the other footage shows that one guy who was really disturbed, and he's pacing around a room surrounded by some of his comrades and physicians saying, "Please don't kill me, please don't kill me, please don't kill me." So he's having a really bad trip. You know, this is British Army doing this in the 50s. The U.S. Army did it probably the early 60s. The U.S. Army was doing it around the same time. No IRB. By field testing. So if it's field testing, it's not research. Right? It's field testing. And again, the thought was, well, you know, maybe this could be put into an enemy's water supply, or somehow you could aerosolize it. You could obviously really disrupt enemy forces if you tried to do this. What I think is so interesting is, and I know I'm pushing the national security side tonight a lot, the military side, because it's a key part of the history of neuroscience. And I'm going to come up to the contemporary stuff in a minute. But, you know, if you think about it, LSD comes out of pharma in the 40s. It goes into the national security environment when nobody's heard about it. And then in the 60s, through people like Leary, it gets into the culture. So this is a kind of interesting transit of the way that some of the technologies can move. It's a great example of sort of, you know, you might use in the Science Technology Society course about how the ripple effects of a technology can't necessarily be anticipated. And that's clearly what happened with LSD. And could happen with some of the other stuff that I'm going to show you in the next few minutes. By the way, when I first started teaching in the program, the master's program, I noticed that the schedule of these courses officially is 4:30 to 7:20. So I'm not going to keep people until 7:20. They get tired. Even if you take a biology break, people still need to get out. So I'll let people go at 7:00. Then I started hearing rumors. It's funny, you know, nobody tells anything directly. The rumor was, Jesus, Moreno's keeping people until 7:00. You know, everybody else is allowed about at 6:30. So I'm what am I a schmuck? I'm working an extra half hour, and people don't want to be there. You know, so. Anyway, so we'll leave at 6:30. Not to worry. But I do want to walk you through some of the contemporary stuff that's related to neuroscience, national security, counterintelligence, and enhancement. And this is some of the stuff that I talk about in the book. Some of you know about Provigil. Anybody use Provigil? Don't be shy. I have used Provigil. You know what it is, right? So it's going off patent, I believe, next year. The NIH and IMH has found that Provigil, it's modafinil, brand is Provigil, can keep you awake and alert for 60 to 80 hours without any noticeable loss of function, any measurable loss of function, tension. Now being taken as a supplement to speed by Air Force pilots, you know, the history of keeping warfighters awake and alert and not making mistakes is one of the basic challenges that commanders have. In the late 19th century, the Prussian army experimented with cocaine. Of course, so did Freud. Right? That didn't work so well. In the 20th century, it was what kept soldiers going? In combat, you're running around 4 hours of sleep, right? With live ammunition. So it was what? Nicotine, right? Which was dexedrine, right? Especially in the 50s, Korea. During the Second World War, the big tobacco companies advertised how generous they were by sending millions and millions of cartons of cigarettes over to our boys. And, of course, when they came over, they were completely hooked, right? So this is just genius marketing. And then, of course, there's also caffeine.
There really isn't much. And then SPD came along, sort of in the Vietnam era, got to be more popular on campus as well as in Vietnam. And it really is, it's amazing how little there is. Although we chat a lot about cognitive enhancement, there's really very little that really enhances. And you can take a brisk walk, you know. There are definitely people on campus here at Penn who believe that this is no more dangerous than caffeine. So I have no doubt but that when it goes off patent, and this company, Cephalon, right out here near Philly, starts making a lot more of it, that it's going to be, there's going to be a huge market. It's going to be much easier to get. There already is a kind of a black market in modafinil, but I had, in 2006, in December, I was giving my last talk at UVA, and I mentioned modafinil, and this little girl raised her hand. Oh, yeah, I take that. Really? How'd you get it? Oh, my father has sleep disorder. He gave some to me for exams, for exam period. Oh, okay. How'd it work? Great. It was great. It's now being used by shift workers. It's approved for, I should say, it was approved for narcolepsy. And I had a student, an undergrad, a couple of years ago, who volunteered in my big 80 undergraduate lecture class that she was on it, because she has narcolepsy. People, it's approved by the FDA for people with narcolepsy, but it's being prescribed for shift workers, for people up to fly, like professors, academics up to fly, they're here to try and get a paper. Anjan Chatterjee here in neurology says his prescription for his colleagues who are flying across many time zones to go to an academic meeting is Ambien when you get on the plane, and modafinil when you get off the plane. That's the travel pack. And John also coined the term cosmetic neurology. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of this kind of thing. Not everybody is a big responder. I will tell you, I'm not a big responder to this stuff, but it depends on where you are in your sleep cycle. Psychologist told me, among other things. But when it works pretty well. It's not that you don't feel tired, but it doesn't bother you. It puts your fatigue in a box and puts it over to the side, is the way I would describe it. It's quite interesting. And it is definitely more comfortable than a lot of coffee when you're tired. No question about it. So this is definitely going to be a bigger on-campus drug. I don't think there's any question about that. There's also been a lot of talk about oxytocin. You heard about this? So there's some neuroscience suggests that, oxytocin is the stuff we make. Right, all the time, when we're in trusting situations, it's associated with sociability, with affection. When women who are delivering are given Pitocin, it's a version of oxytocin that stimulates the letdown reflex, it speeds up labor. There is some evidence that you can actually deliver it on a nasal spray. And in some social psychology experiments, competitive experiments, whereas there's trading or buying and selling or negotiating, it seems to make people more cooperative. And so one question is whether you could actually give people a shot of oxytocin in an interrogation situation. And they would talk more freely, more openly. This actually might turn out to be, if you used it today, in a, used in a mythical place like Guantanamo, it would probably be a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. But if it was used by the cops in Philadelphia, it wouldn't be. Because the international conventions only apply internationally. They don't apply domestically. So I don't know if anybody's ever tried this in a police situation. I don't think so. But there's a lot of literature about it right now. And I don't know if this works, but something like it might work. But it's also, I'd like to tell my undergraduates, because they're all interested in love, especially in the spring when they give these lectures, that it's also when you're in sort of doing your love, you're making lots of oxytocin, supposedly. So just to disabuse them of romance is really, all chemicals. This is what oxytocin looks like on the protein that carries it around your brain. It's a little less romantic. Actually, it doesn't really look like that. With stick figures, as you know, but that's the model. So, quite a bit less romantic.
Yeah.
What's it used for? What's it prescribed for besides the letdown response? Like, why is it used?
It's not.
It's not a prescription drug.
No, it's not. But you're making it. You can get it. Well, it's used for, it's Pitocin that's used. It's used for women who are in delivery. Is it used for anything else?
Not that I know.
I don't think so. That's the only...
There's trials for people who help us.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. That's exactly right.
To increase their social interaction.
Exactly. Yeah, trust again. Right? Yeah, but not in regular clinical practice. I think Pitocin is the only thing that's used. But yeah, I mean, autism, other people with mental disorders might be, you know, it might be very useful. People with catatonia. By the way, if you're at all interested in this stuff, there's going to be a conference in October here at Penn called Psychedemia. There's already a website, which is the word they made it up. It's a combination of psychedelics and academia. And I, of course, am on the advisory board. It's going to cover everything from clinical trials using psychedelics or other hallucinogens, which are now starting again. There's interest in using psychedelics in depression and anxiety disorders. So there's going to be some of that discussion. There's also going to be arts around psychedelics, literature, painting. I don't know what the hell else is going to go on. I'll probably give my Mind Wars talk around psychedelics. There is a renewed interest in this stuff. As you probably know, LSD was reclassified around 1965, when it started to become sort of known to the authorities that it was being used for recreational purposes. My father actually had a tax stamp that I can see. I wish I still had it. A tax stamp that enabled him to get quantities of LSD, marijuana with an H, and cocaine from the federal government for use in research. And that, of course, that went away. That whole research area went away in the mid-1960s. At least legally, it did. There's been also been theorizing, still doing more drugs about beta blockers and the possibility that you could use something like propanolol before or after somebody has been in a traumatic situation. Robert Pittman at Harvard did these experiments starting in the 90s. He went to emergency rooms. He found people who had just been the victims of violent crime. He got their informed consent, and he assigned them to a couple of different research arms. In one arm, they got talk therapy, and in the other arm, they got talk therapy plus propanolol. I was on a panel with him about, I guess, 4 years ago, now, at the NIH. He doesn't think this really works. But there was some theorizing in the bioethics world that maybe you could actually give people something like this prophylactically before they went into a traumatic situation. So what if you could give propanolol to a combat soldier before he or she went into conflict? Could you use that as a prophylaxis against post-traumatic stress disorder? Right. Now, Pittman doesn't think this could work with anything that we have now. But he did allow, at least in this event at the NIH, that someday somebody will come up with something that could do this. Interesting question is, how do you do the experiments? Right? How do you do the clinical trials? And then what it seems to do is it seems to block the association of an experience with a strong emotion. And it works on the hippocampus, because that's where, you know, that's the buffer where you take in experience and then you associate with an emotion, and then it gets filed away somewhere else in the brain. So it seems to block that process. So what if you had an unemotional, you know, a soldier who would come back from combat who was completely unemotional about his or her experiences in combat? No PTSD, but also a whole cohort, a whole generation of soldiers with no guilt, no shame, no regret. Interesting ethical question. Probably a good one for a paper. Would that be ethically acceptable? I think it'd be hard. This is another drawing. I'm just doing this really fast. Another kind of chemical study. I love the web because you never know what you get off the web. So this is the top half of a two-page contract. This was led by, as you can see, an entity called the Marine Corps Research University, which is at Penn State. Penn State, by the way, will take classified research. Penn will not. There's an interesting, just in terms of the way this works in the academic world, there is no industry standard on this. Some institutions will take sponsored research that's classified. Some won't, and then there's a bunch in the middle. There are places that won't take it on campus, like MIT or Hopkins, but then they'll set up places off campus to do it. The philosophy is, we don't want to interfere with academic freedom by having classified research, so we'll put it off campus. Okay. The title of this project is a technical assessment of the 81mm non-lethal mortar munition. What's a non-lethal mortar? So the notice that this was, before I tell you the punchline, a notice that this was prepared in, about 8 days after 9/11. Interesting. So I called my friend F. Roy Dietrich, who works on biological weapons and stuff, and I said, "All right, what's a non-lethal mortar?" I read all the Sergeant Fury comic books, you know, when I was growing up, and I saw all the John Wayne movies. And I thought that a mortar is something that'll kill you. And he said, "Well," thought for a second, "I think it would be something that would put you to sleep." Non-lethal mortar. So this is what it looks like. It's obviously an aerosol. And here's an example of where it apparently... Anybody want to guess what this is? Any of the docs? You've heard of this. You know this stuff.
Well, you spent all of that...
You got it.
That Moscow...
Exactly. Thank you. Good segue. So this is exactly what was used, fentanyl or maybe carfentanil, in this tragedy in the Moscow theater. There were several people in the theater taken hostage. Remember this? After a few days, the conditions had deteriorated. The Russian special forces decided that they would resolve the problem by pumping fentanyl into the ducts, the heating ducts. Unfortunately, they didn't tell the EMTs why people were being brought out unconscious. Otherwise, they could have used the antidote, which was readily known, and 120 people died. Most of the children died who were still in the theater. Interestingly, there's a question about whether this was a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. Because although it was, this is really it's sort of in the weeds, but you know, for the lawyers in the room, it's maybe of some interest to you. Again, this was a domestic situation, right? So the treaty technically didn't apply. And these were terrorists from Chechnya, but they were in Russia. However, what happened in the theater was that after they released this stuff, and people were in terrible condition, they were dehydrated, they were miserable, the men among the hostage takers went out into the hall, because they knew something was going on, to face Russian special forces who were coming in, right, armed to the teeth. And they were killed by Russian special forces. The agents then went into the theater where they saw the women, who, as you can see, were in burqas, asleep because of the fentanyl that they inhaled. And they shot them. They killed them. Right. Now, one lawyer has told me, this is a few years ago, a national lawyer guy said, you know, that actually might have been a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. Because if it's a police action, you would handcuff them. You know, you use the least force required. If it's a military action, you use as much force as you have to resolve the problem. So that raises an interesting legal question. Now, six of the families of the people who died actually went to International Criminal Court and sued the Russians about this. This was decided in December. It was decided that they shouldn't have handled that way, but that there was no... there was a very minor monetary compensation for the families, $2,000. Sort of interesting, yeah.
So why did that end up, I assume it was the fentanyl that killed them?
The fentanyl put them to sleep, And then they became unconscious, and they were not revived in time because it, you know, it suppresses your respiration.
Okay. So would be non-lethal.
It would have been non-lethal if the physicians outside, and there were dozens of ambulances outside, had known what they were getting. Yeah. So there was no communication between special forces and physicians.
How did that order non-lethal?
Well, it would have been non-lethal if they'd known that they were what would happen to them. This is the problem, right? The term non-lethal is very commonly used these days to refer to a lot of different devices, chemicals. For example, you have rubber bullets. Non-lethal also includes this heat ray. You heard about this?
Yeah, it makes you uncomfortable and get out of the way of it.
Yeah, exactly. There's this heat ray that actually causes you to feel as though you're on fire. It raises the temperature of the liquid in your cells.
It's supposed to be used for crowd control.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's also classified as a non-lethal weapon. But this is obviously, these are obviously better called less than lethal, right? I mean, because this obviously wasn't.
For that application you just showed in the picture, you would have to deploy it with a team of medics?
Yeah, you would. Yeah. Yeah.
Not necessarily, because about 150 people survived. So it's a dose dependent phenomenon, so it depends on how close you are to the mission.
Right,
it was
true enough. Yeah. But it wasn't lethal for a lot of people.
Although, the one I really loved was the microwave that's supposed to give troops in the trenches homosexual urges.
Oh, yeah. yeah. There was that's actually one of my favorites, though. In that same category, there's another one that. That was theorized in Vietnam, maybe you know this one. The idea was that maybe you could make an odor that was so disgusting that you could pump it, you could aerosolize it into the tunnels that the Viet Cong used, and it was such a disgusting odor that it would drive them out of the tunnels. So they actually did prepare this stuff. There, as a result of that, there is something called standard government toilet odor. It's very noxious, something like that. It's very noxious odor. They tried it. The problem is that what we didn't think about was the fact that the Viet Cong had grown up on farms, and so it didn't bother them. You know. But our guys had come from the inner city, and you know they can smell stuff like that. Sewage disposal. So it didn't work so well. So there are a bunch of...
Actually, there was one that after Desert Storm, there was one that they're working on that was supposed to be a microwave frequency that you could beam at opposing troops. And it actually was supposed to stimulate amorous feelings, but also towards same-sex amorous feelings.
Uh-huh. So don't ask, don't
there's
tell,
a,
don't smell.
There's a weak effect. It didn't work out.
Didn't work out.
They tried.
Yeah. That's terrific. I'd love to have the source of that. By the way, somebody told me that... So Steve Brittell, who's in the program, who as many of you know is a major and an Army chaplain. We were at a meeting together last week, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell came up. And as you probably know, the way that that's been resolved is that the Pentagon just said, okay, that's not a crime under the CMJ. That's the end of that. However, adultery still is. So it's sort of interesting, right? Adultery is still out. You know, there's this... But still, you know, you can't do that, but I don't get it. It does remind me of an old joke about, you know, Moses who comes down from the mountain with the tablets, and he says, there's good news and bad news, he says to the Hebrews. You know, the good news is, I got him down to 10. The bad news is, adultery's still in. So, anyway... Same day that happened in the Moscow Theater, this was not the best day for the National Academy of Sciences, released a report urging centers of excellence, the funding of centers of excellence on non-lethal weapons. So that was not a good time. Okay, I'm going to move really fast here now. You know a lot about this neuroimaging stuff, non-invasive brain imaging that everybody writes books about because we think we can tell who you're going to vote for based on whether you're looking at, you know, Romney's picture or Obama's picture. I think... If there's a system in the brain that is dedicated to smart Harvard guys, they'd be the same. I don't know how you can see. So this is what we're looking at here. This is a DARPA-sponsored project. Some of you may know that DARPA is very interested in trying to figure out how to get more data out of the brain. This is one called the HeadWeb. They're not doing this anymore. This ended a few years ago. But here, this is the basic concept is still of great interest to DARPA. Some of you know about the work of Nicolelis et al. I'm sorry, this is not Nicolelis, of Jack Gallant at Berkeley, who's doing really interesting work trying to see whether he can read your mind. And this is a study that was done, like, 4 or 5 years ago already. Basically, up to 92% accuracy, they can tell, using neuroimaging, what picture you're looking at. Have you seen any of this? This is really interesting, and I think it's probably worth... So, let me see if I can find this for you on YouTube. They're trying to do this in film now. And it's worth finding it if I can. Yeah, here it is. So this is reconstructing visual experience. Okay, so the basic idea here is you're perceiving an you're perceiving a certain image, and this is the way that the computer with is reading it out of your brain. Okay. Here's the image, here's the way it's reading it. Can you see this? Mm-hmm. So reconstruction, and these are the movies that, they're being looked at. Okay, so here's the... This is the... Whoops! We don't need the French, do we? There. So this is... presented clip, and this is the clip that they've been able to reconstruct. This is being done by Jack Gallant and his people at Berkeley. It's pretty fuzzy, but they're getting something. And, you know, with better computing power and more data out of the brain, this is closed the skull, by the way. They're going to be able to get more and more. So, I don't know if you think this is, you know, mind reading or not. But there's clearly something going on here. That's a functional MRI. I think I'm going to say we don't like that noise. So, there's also a paper that was recently published that you can find. I can actually send it to you in PLOS Biology, in which they actually reconstructed sound from patients who are undergoing... I don't know if it's going to come out here. No, it's not. It's now possible to reconstruct sound. They took patients who were with epilepsy, who were undergoing neurosurgery, and they were conscious. So they read some words to them. And then they recorded... which sets of neurons were being stimulated when they had this auditory experience. And then they were able to actually reconstruct the sounds. This was just published about 3 weeks ago in PLOS Biology. So I used to say, the Jack and Lance stuff, the movie that I just showed you, you know, getting stuff out of the visual cortex, that's not hard. Visual cortex is big, we know a lot about it. And then now, just 3 weeks ago, it turns out that the auditory cortex is also accessible. This is this is quite interesting. This is very interesting ethical questions, I think. I don't know if you know about the Roborat. The Roborat is a study that was done as part of a long series of experiments DARPA sponsored at SUNY Downstate Medical School, where I used to work, where there are a lot of rats. And they're not in the labs, necessarily. So the Roborat, you know the Roborat? Very simple experiment. 3 electrodes, one in the central pleasure center, one where the left whiskers are, one for the right whiskers. A grad student, 3 buttons on a laptop computer, pushes one button, the rat moves forward, pushes the left and the center button, rat turns left, center right button, rat turns right. Within a few minutes, they train the rat to do things that rats don't like to do, like climb up to to high places. They don't like walls, standing on walls. They don't like heights. They don't like going up ladders. Rats will do that as long as they're being simulated in this way. And that's a little battery pack and transmitter on his back. This is DARPA sponsored. Why is DARPA interested in this? Well, for one thing, if you have a collapsed building, you know, a full-grown rat can get into a space this size. As long as he can get his nose in, he knows he can get the rest of his little soft little body in. So you can have, you can imagine having a rat with a transmitter and a video camera. And that actually, they have done this to see if there's anybody left in the building with a microphone. Maybe you could use it also for mine clearing. If you blow up some rats, nobody cares. This is actually not a new concept. Some of you interested in the history of psychology might remember that Jose Delgado did this in the bull ring in 1958. He had a little box called the stemoceiver, an electrode in a bull's brain. The bull's charging at him. He pushes it. This is a movie. The bull stops in his tracks. This is Dr. Delgado on the right, by the way, in the bull ring. This is somebody who really believed in his science. I don't know if an IRB would approve that today. Anyway, I'd like to go in the bull ring. No, Dr. Delgado. I think it's time for you to see the psychiatrist. Okay, this is the Nicolelis. Nicolelis is a Brazilian originally. He's in the U.S. at Duke. This is now well established. You can do this with people with locked-in syndrome now. It started out with I think it was a rhesus monkey. Basic idea is rhesus monkey figures out how to move a cursor on a computer screen just by thinking and gets a reward. Simple. It's done now with people with locked-in syndrome who are quads. This is also DARPA. So you can really think about the possibilities here. If you want to have an exoskeleton that's very powerful, if you want to control a robot from long distances, this is all doable. This is sort of part of the idea of the robot army of the future, which is an idea that people have had for quite a while. There are, as you may know, there are now more drone pilots being trained, remote drone pilots being trained, in the U.S. Air Force than there are traditional pilots. It raises very interesting questions, but there's also a lot of discussion going on, not only about remote drones using brain-machine interface technologies like this. There's also a notion that's going around now among the war colleges called autonomous lethal engagement. Anybody heard of autonomous lethal engagement? You will. The idea of autonomous lethal engagement is that you give a weapon system complete control over when it decides to fire or not. There's already a system that is on the DMZ in Korea that was built by Samsung that can go on autopilot. It can decide to shoot at any living thing it wants to in the DMZ. There are some weapon systems on ships that have operated pretty much autonomously for quite a while with human monitoring. So the more we learn about the brain, the better we get at artificial intelligence, the better we are also going to get at biometrics, face recognition. There's an interesting debate now about whether autonomous lethal engagement is acceptable according to the military ethos, giving over so much control to basically a machine. Let's see, I'm going to show you. So this is, there are other technologies being used too. This is Jamie Tyler, who is a great believer in that we haven't done enough with some other technologies, and he's at Virginia Tech in Carilion. So this is he's interested in ultrasound. He believes that there's much more to be learned from ultrasound, and that we really need to improve the technology. So again, this is all closed brain stuff. This is not deep brain stimulation. This is also, by the way, all dual use, right? For physicians, for neurologists, for example, it would be great to be able to get continuous feedback about what's going on in, say, a Parkinson's patient's brain in between visits to the clinic. So it's the dual-use part of it that perhaps to propel all this stuff forward. It raises the interesting ethical questions. This is Kevin Warwick, a guy who likes to get a lot of publicity in the UK, a neuroscientist. This is Kevin and his wife. Kevin rigged up himself and his wife is with his necklace, so that every time he has a thought, her necklace lights up. I'm not sure what the point of that is, except it did get him a lot of publicity. And he published a book called Sideword. And he's got himself like permanently wired with some stuff in his arm. The technology to watch for all this is something called optogenetics. Being done here at Penn, the pioneer is at Stanford. Very interesting because we're able to study the connections among neurons, which is really where the action is in the brain. So you can light up a protein, follow where it goes, and you can also make it go to certain places. This is very exciting. Genetics. People are very optimistic that a lot is going to be learned from optogenetics. Of course, there's direct transcranial stimulation or TMS, transcranial stimulation. A lot of interesting work being done in TMS. This is just a simple device held over their brain, reverses a magnetic flow and magnetic poles and ion channels. There are some interesting studies in ethics using TMS. People before the test, they're measured as deontologists. The famous trolley thing where you push somebody over to save 10 people. People who measured in one way, as say deontologists, who wouldn't do that? Oh no, we shouldn't do that. Measure utilitarians when they're under the magnet. If you hold it in exactly the right place. So it can actually change your moral judgment. This is pretty serious stuff. You heard about this?
Is that true?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Well, it's true that there are studies that have shown that have found this. Whether it's true that it actually happens, maybe the studies are flawed, I don't know. But this is what the studies purport to conclude. So you can go online and see on YouTube, there's films about TMS. And there's going to be more and more of this because people think that you can actually use it to wake people up. Soldiers or others, maybe you can put in a cat, they're getting tired, you give them a zap. But it has to be done in exactly the right way. More brain-machine interfaces that people are working on. Finally, are there any ethical principles here? I've been talking a lot of science and a lot of national security and all the creepy stuff. Are there any ethical principles? I don't know. One that's been suggested is cognitive liberty, that my thoughts should be controlled by me and that I should be the only one who has access to them. I should be the only one who, or at least who can decide who should have access to them. Cognitive liberty, that kind of makes sense. It makes sense unless you talk to the evolutionary biologists and psychologists who say, you know what? We know what the other people are thinking around us for the most part anyway. That's why we're so good at mating. I mean, if we weren't good at reading minds, you know, we would never make more of us. We read micro-expressions all the time. So how private are we really? Not nearly as private as we think. Now, that doesn't necessarily justify, you know, secretly taping what somebody is thinking or dreaming about, but I'm just saying, cognitive liberty, while it looks good on the surface, so to speak, may not go as far as we would like to think. And then finally, reversibility, which comes in for the first user or for the experiment. You know, what we do to somebody should be reversible, shouldn't be permanent. Well, that's easy to say also, but the truth is we do a lot of stuff to people, and certainly in medicine, including clinical trials, that we don't know if it's reversible. So these are principles. They're principles. They're very general. They might be moving us in the right direction for some of these things. And then, of course, once you get into the military stuff, the question whether it is acceptable to have autonomous robots working on neuroscience principles. They're really smart, really creative, really spontaneous. They recognize context. From an international law standpoint, is that acceptable? Really smart drones, that can make their own decisions about when to fire and when not to, is that acceptable? So there are a lot of interesting ethical issues here that are not necessarily covered by these two principles. Sean?
No, I'm just adding to your principles. I mean, obviously the research ethics principles that, but also privacy.
Yeah.
If I can know what you're thinking, No, beyond that, like intellectual property and ownership, it's not just you tell what you're thinking, but now I can, if I can really tell with specificity, yeah. I'm going to know what your formula is you've developed for yeah. something. So I think there's a whole...
Could be, yeah. And then, you know, that would be a first to file everywhere, so... right? So, if I know what you're thinking, then I can file it before you can. And I got the patent. So, this is a rich area for people to work on. People who want to keep working on bioethics, I think, you know, this question of what the additional principles or standards are beyond the usual ones for bioethics and for research ethics, this is virgin territory. There's a lot of stuff to be done here. And then, whenever I go to meetings outside the U.S., I'm reminded that there's international law, which we never talk about in the U.S. You know, there are human rights conventions, there are humanitarian conventions, and there are disarmament conventions, and they all either apply in some way to this stuff, or they may need to be massaged in order to apply. A lot of the neuroscience may not fall under the biological or chemical weapons conventions. It's not clear. So there are people right now, particularly in Europe, who are talking about a new convention for neuroscience and neurotechnology. The problem is, this field is moving so fast that it's, you know, and it takes 20, 30 years for international treaties to be signed by all the parties, all the sovereign states. People are really worried that it's going to be hard to capture the technology, that it's moving faster than anything given biological and chemical. So... let's see, one more thing just to creep you out a little bit. This is a conference that I was part of, a workshop in December of 2010. This is on the neurobiology of political violence. Very interesting. This took place at the NIH, but you see it's DARPA, it's mostly DOD, STRATCOM, NORTHCOM. Here the question is, using neuroscience, using genetics, using wet lab technologies, is it possible to identify people who are more likely than others to engage in political violence? There are people who are actually looking at this stuff. I have no idea whether it can be done or not, but I can tell you that there are people who believe it can be done and that it will be done. That you can identify potential terrorists, just as you can identify that little three-year-old kid who's going to turn into a 10-year-old kid who pulls the wings off, you know, flies for fun. And who then goes on to be some kind of a violent criminal. There are absolutely people who believe that general line of thinking could someday be applied to even to political violence, which is a pretty abstract behavioral concept. So this is a white paper that was done to summarize the conference. Okay, so there's other things going on that I'm not going to keep you longer because I know it is past 6:30, but just want to show you that if you want to read any more about these things, there are several recent National Academy of Sciences reports, specifically on neuroscience and national security. I was part of this one. Notice the sponsorship, Defense Intelligence Agency. It's a serious business. So that's on the web also, free. You can read it. This is one. Sorry about the image that got screwed up here, but this is one called Army Opportunities in Neuroscience, published in 2009. Also sponsored by the Army. Also on the web. This is one on field testing of cognitive tools and methods. This is a handheld lie detector, which is junk. But it is being used in the green zone in Baghdad to screen locals for employment. It has three lights on it, by the way. You want to know what they are? Light detector,
yellow,
right?
Red.
Yellow, red, and green. Yeah. DOD really likes this because you can train a 19-year-old to use it in 10 minutes. This replaced the voice stress analyzer, which is supposed to be a lie detector, which was even more junk than this thing. This, depending on who you talk to, this is sort of 70-75% accuracy. The voice stress analyzer was just 50-50. No better than guessing. So, that's it. You know, I'd be happy to stick around and chit-chat.
you're really paranoid now, you do not want to go out in the dark. So that's ethics and neuroscience, circa 2012. Who knows, a couple of years from now, it could be even more interesting.
Wow.
Bye.
Thank you.